You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The 10th parallel, which is situated several hundred miles north of the equator, is one of the world's major non-geologic fault lines. Although more than half of the world's Muslims and even more of its Christians live near it, religious differences are not the only sources of conflict along this line that runs through Nigeria, East Africa, and Southeast Asia. In her best-selling book, The 10th Parallel, Eliza Griswold chronicles life in countries that lie in this often troubled area and profiles the people who fuel the crises and violence. She was on our show in August, and we are re-airing our conversation for you on this Thanksgiving holiday. I began by asking Eliza Griswold, although they're not always religious, can we say that most of the conflicts that happen along the 10th Parallel are sectarian?
Yes, absolutely. There are all sorts of forms of identity. In places where nations are weak or have failed that I've seen, other forms of identity come to the fore. Most of all, that is religion, primarily, more than ethnicity, which is interesting to me, and even more than race.
Tribal?
Tribal, yes, but tribal unified under an umbrella of religion. Because usually what's happened is people have come from outside, be they Muslim or Christian, and converted huge swaths of people. And because the larger the group, the more powerful they are, that they unify under Christianity or Islam.
Are they also resource conflicts?
100%. They're resource conflicts over, you know, what's happening in that area, and we're certainly seeing this now in Somalia, is the pattern of desertification, of droughts, and actually extreme floods. Both are intensifying.
At the same time that there's population growth and there is all sorts of other conflict that's preventing people from even getting food in crisis situations.
Absolutely. One odd thing that actually has been a source of conflict in Indonesia between Christians and Muslims is chocolate. The principal ingredient, cacao, is grown on a little island called Sulawesi. And when global prices of chocolate spiked, so too did violence between Christians and Muslims.
Which is interesting to me because I've always thought of Indonesia as a Muslim country. It's the world's has the world's largest Muslim population. How large is its Christian population?
It's pretty small. I mean, 90% is Muslim and about – it's – you know, I love religious statistics because they're more heated than Republican-Democrat statistics. Everyone's always arguing they're more. So,
well, they must have a tea party in Indonesia.
Well, they you know what they have? They have – well, Malaysia nearby had a group of people called the Teapot People, which was an Islamic sect. Of course, they became heretical, but they worshipped a giant teapot in northern Malaysia. They didn't make it into the book, but that must have been some of my favorite reporting.
So why was the tension between Christians and Muslims over chocolate?
Because, again, exactly what you were saying about resource conflict. What happened traditionally, and this is a lot of the patterns along the 10th parallel, are patterns of how people arrived and how people were colonized, because religion came right along with colonialization. So in Indonesia, a lot of the islands look in the east look like bullseyes with Islamic rims because Islam got there first and sailing and trading. And then Christian Dutch colonialists came in and converted people in the center, largely because people in the center couldn't had to eat pork as a principal protein. So, and pork is haram. It's forbidden under Islam. So essentially what happened is the Christians are poor on the islands, and yet they're the landholders. And the Muslims have a lot more money. They started buying up the land where you could grow chocolate. And it was a land conflict that took on the colors of religion.
Since September 11th, the phrase clash of civilizations has been thrown around a lot. Is that a good way to describe what's happening along the 10th parallel?
I would say not. In fact, a lot of what I did essentially was spend 7 years in jungles and droughts and villages to see what happens on the ground where Christianity and Islam meet. Is there a clash of civilizations or not? And I would say, first of all, there are certainly rising tensions between strains of Christians and Muslims. To deny that would be naive. But the greatest and most overlooked religious struggles of our time are those inside of religions, not between them.
It's also interesting that clash of civilizations has come to mean, in many people's minds, an anti-Islamic attitude.
I would say that's absolutely true, because what it does is posits, you know, Islam as the other, as the enemy, and we are in need of defense. And that is something, certainly, that gesture is, especially with the Christian right, and with the Muslim right, too, this idea of the clash of civilizations is very popular. You know, because it's like, ooh, if you believe in that, you have to unify behind me. I'll defend you.
I want to get to that whole business of the fights within the religions in a moment. But on the broader picture, you focus on Nigeria, Sudan, Somalia, Indonesia, Malaysia, and the Philippines. And each of these countries has its own set political and social problems. But do you think that the same theses apply to all of them?
Well, the same theses apply that resources have a huge role in religious struggle, and we can't separate out, you know, the drought from the fight between Christians and Muslims. So this kind of interconnected reality of conflict, and also this prevalence of the greatest tensions are inside the religion. Besides that, there are no generalizations. And a lot of what I try and do with the book, which I think can be maddening to readers, is there's not a lot of – they're very particular conflicts.
Well, this book was published in hardcover last year. Has much changed since last year?
You know, the book foreshadows a couple of things that have changed to the good and to the bad.
Well, there's Sudan and Somalia, and that's for the bad.
Exactly. Well, Sudan, you know, we see some positive with the liberation, which is how the Southerners would see it, the world's newest country in southern Sudan. Really a murky divide, but that belongs along the 10th parallel because of historical divides there. We have seen – that's positive. Largely.
But there's been war over territory, and Darfur still hasn't been resolved because that's not part of the new country that's been
absolutely
created.
Absolutely. And the place that I spent the most time is a little town called Abyei that became the largest flashpoint once again in this division between North and South. We also have to note that what's going on right now in a place called South Kordofan, Blue Nile, people who had an allegiance to the South historically have fallen behind the curtain of the North, and they are absolutely getting just wiped out. And they've fallen out of the news cycle because we can't get there.
Well, we think of these things as being foreign. How much of a U.S. presence is there along the 10th parallel?
You know, one thing that I really learned while doing this book is that the longest U.S. presence is, of course, a missionary presence. But because before there was such a thing as secular human rights there or the U.N. or anything like that, the Westerners who were in Africa and in Southeast Asia were Christian missionaries. And that's definitely shaped a lot of the thinking for people who live there.
Well, before then, were the Muslims Islamic missionaries or they were conquering armies in some cases. Proselytizing seems to have been powerful on all sides.
Absolutely.
I almost said both sides, but it more than two, isn't
exactly.
It?
No, that's definitely the truth. And I wanted to see with religions that feel it's part of their mandate to make others believers, what happens on the ground.
Do you think that fundamentalist strains of religion almost always give way to violence?
Yes, I would say they do because – now, that's not always true because when you sort of start parsing Islamic groups, we have some of the hardest core traditionalists, the Salafia. Some of these guys who, you know, Al-Qaeda would see itself as Salafia. But some of the people in this oldest strain who say, you know, we hearken back to the, you know, 8th century, they decry violence because they say there's no such thing as a legitimate Islamic leader today. And until there is, this is all politics.
My guest is Eliza Griswold. Her book, The 10th Parallel, Dispatches from the Fault Line Between Christianity and Islam. It's now available in paperback from Picador. Has there always been tension? Or have people generally gotten along until more recently?
There have been periods of tension, but there's also one of my favorite stories that I learned in the course of reporting this book was that really before in the 630s, before there was such a thing as Islam, when Muhammad was under siege by his own people in Saudi Arabia, what's today Saudi Arabia, he sent a small group of his followers to the court of a Christian king, the king of Abyssinia in today's Ethiopia. And these guys, these early Muslims, asked for safe haven from the Christian king. And what they did is they told him the story of Mary, because the Gospel of Mary is in the Islamic Quran. So And the king said, sure, you can stay. And there's still descendants of these same group in Ethiopia today. So that's one of those ancient stories of cooperation I love.
And since elements of Judaism and Christianity have been incorporated to Islam, shouldn't we expect there to be less tension? What happened?
Well, what happened is...
Is it a matter of competing for souls?
There is certainly that. that aspect to it. What's happening is that I think we're in this radical upswing where their religious reawakening has a role that is larger than ever. And that's happening both inside of Christianity and inside of Islam, where believers say, you know what, I have a direct relationship with God. And because I know what God wants, I can read my text word by word, and I know who's going to be saved and who's going to be damned. And that's when religion gets especially dangerous.
A listener, Patrick from the Bronx, is wondering if the recent creation of Southern Sudan is the latest chapter in the conflict between Christianity and Islam.
There's certainly that as a factor. I mean, one could say a lot of the Southern Sudanese see themselves as early Christians. They can actually trace their Christianity back to the Bible, back to the Book of Acts and the conversion of the first African eunuch. So there is definitely an element of we are Christians and we are now liberated. But to say that that's the only factor in that conflict or in the development of that country would not be true at all. There are many, many factors in Southern Sudan's formation.
You mentioned that some of the strongest tension is between various groups within a religion. We usually think of that mostly in terms of Sunni and the Shiite. And I've seen that in mail that I've gotten from listeners. One time I talked about them as being two strains of Islam, and a listener wrote in, no, the Shiites are heretics, and they are not Muslims in any way. And I got a feeling the next line was going to be, and we should kill them all.
Absolutely. We have that without that last line. We have that within Christianity, too. I mean, this idea of who's a true believer and who's not.
Catholics, Pentecostals, Evangelicals.
Absolutely. Especially with these religious reawakenings on both sides. This idea of being born again, and that's certainly not true at all of most Evangelicals, but there's certainly a group that believe, you know, unless Jesus is the only way. If you haven't chosen Jesus, you're going to hell.
And Pentecostalism is growing very fast in parts of Africa.
Hugely.
Leading to all sorts of political issues in a country like Uganda.
Absolutely. I mean, Pentecostalism, actually there are even these Muslim Pentecostals now in Nigeria, a group called Nasfat, and they have their own cola called Nasmalt. They run a dating service. They were always trying to get me to sign up for it. They have a travel agency. And what they say is, look, Christianity, we have to compete. We meet on Sundays, we play the drums, we have music, we dress in white, we speak in tongues, because why should the Christians have all the fun? We need members too.
So they're taking the trappings of evangelical Christianity?
100%.
They're becoming charismatic Muslims?
1,000. It's a crazy, crazy movement. It's so interesting to see.
And is it appealing to people?
It's appealing to people, and it's 100% self-aware. That's what's so curious to me. It's not sort of like, oh, we like this. It's, you know what? We're competing with the Christians. We're competing in the workplace, too. And we can help people get jobs as we can help them, you know, get to Mecca, and we can help you get a date, you sad, lonely girl.
That's the second time you've mentioned that.
No, I don't. I am all set, thank you. But I think in Nigeria it was odd to see me traveling alone, a little disconcerting to people.
Eliza Griswold, her book, The Tenth Parallel, Dispatches from the Fault Line Between Christianity and Islam, a notable book from the New York Times Book Review last year, and a bestseller, now available in paperback from Picador. One of the things that we talked about was a collection of poems that Eliza Griswold had published in 2007, and I asked her, so how does this work? Do you do the journalism to support your poetry habit? Do you write the poetry as a kind of safety valve when the pressures of journalism are getting to you?
I write the poems when I am reporting. Well, the poetry came first. So if I weren't doing this work, I'd be writing poetry, as my dad always threatens me, writing poetry about hanging laundry, which there's some wonderful poems about laundry. So, but I write the poems now about things that I can't figure out, whether they're sometimes frightening to me or I feel morally implicated or I can't figure them out.
And this is why some journalists write novels.
Yes.
Because there are certain things they just can't put into a book of journalism.
Yes, I think that's exactly right. And the attention to looking at things, I have another book of poems due late this summer. Whether I make that deadline or not, we'll see. But the attention to looking at things, whether it's a conflict zone or a painting or even internal landscapes, is the same.
Is Africa, where we're seeing most of the tension between Islam and various Christian groups, thinking of, on the one hand, some of the things that have happened with Coptics in Egypt recently, and then, of course, there's the Kingdom of Abyssinia, which still considers itself the earliest Christian nation.
Africa, places where governments are weak, that same idea of other forms of identity coming to the fore. So religion in Africa is really something of another nature. People's belief in God patterns their everyday lives in a way that is unusual for us.
Didn't the Prophet Muhammad visit Abyssinia, which is, of course, the modern-day Ethiopia and Eritrea?
He sent those dozen followers. He sent his earliest followers there. So his daughter was one of the people.
Is part of the problem that the lines that created these countries were created by Europeans? For example, Nigeria strikes me as logically three countries.
Absolutely. I mean, the idea of carving up Africa, the whole scramble for Africa in the late 1800s, and creating these crazy divisions by some, you know, you can kind of imagine some colonial administrator late at night rolling up his sleeves and taking a pen, and it's just devastating to see what those lines have done on the ground.
In the case of Nigeria, it's also a place that has a lot of oil and the best kind of oil.
The best kind of oil. It's the U.S.'s fifth largest supplier of oil, and yet most Nigerians live on $1 or $2 a day.
Because it has an incredibly dysfunctional political system. Does that grow out of the tensions along the fault line that we've been talking about?
It doesn't really. I mean, what really how Nigeria works, it's federal, so it's state by state. It's so corrupt that, according to Human Rights Watch, between $4 and $8 billion have been embezzled by the government every year for the last decade. So, you know, it's the curse of oil.
But there are other issues. The House of the North claimed that during the colonial period they were discriminated against, and so there's an affirmative action program to get them more education, get them more jobs, which is resented by the people in the South.
Absolutely. And there are all sorts of long-standing tensions, and this is where religion comes in. And, you know, I find these conversations in New York a lot where friends will say, come on, doesn't it all boil down to political economy, to haves and have-nots? And the answer is no, it doesn't. For many of the people who live along the 10th parallel, and really the 10th parallel and beyond in the world, we have to understand in this area we call the Global South how profound daily belief in God is. God means everything.
But you note that the number of Christians in Nigeria has gone from 176,000 just a century ago to nearly 50 million today. What's accounting for that incredible explosion in population?
Well, I mean, first of all, there's population growth. Second of all, there's the attractive. A lot of the Christianity that's growing fastest in Africa says that it's the gospel of prosperity. You know, get rich quick. Like one of my favorite prosperity preachers said to me, you know, what kind of father wants his sons to be poor? That's what Jesus is. And so this idea that you can improve yourself and be a good Christian at the same time is super attractive. And guess it comes from the West.
The civil war in Nigeria, the Biafran War, was between Christians and Christians, wasn't it?
It was more, again, it was one of those wars that breaks down across a few fault lines. No, because it also posited, you know, the Christian south to the east against the Muslim north as well.
Uh-huh. The Hausa joined with the Yoruba.
Exactly.
In opposition to the Igbo.
Exactly. So
that sounds almost tribal rather than religious.
It was absolutely primarily tribal. And again, with the way that these wars break down, there is no single factor. Like with the chocolate crops, you think, come on, guys, this is about chocolate. Why are you wearing a cross on your shirt and talking about crusade?
One Christian pastor told you that he was ready to die for his faith and added, all we can do is prepare our people for martyrdom. Now, I can think of several much more productive things he could be encouraging people to be doing in a country like Nigeria. Why isn't he pushing for a different agenda, like better education for his people, public health, food production?
Because the quickest way to whip up followers is this perceived threat of an enemy. And he's a politically savvy and very, very common. That's a voice I heard a lot. And a lot of the pastors who live along the 10th parallel, first of all, there's been a lot of killing of Christians. So this notion of persecution, which sounds so outdated to us, is very real for many of the people living there.
In the north, in the border areas between the predominantly Muslim and the predominantly Christian areas.
Exactly. Right along that 10th parallel, that's where violence has been the worst, in what's called the Middle Belt. And these guys, many of them, believe that they are on the forefront of a global confrontation between Islam and Christianity. And what happens, as in Uganda, but in Nigeria as well, Western evangelical leaders hear those voices of persecution and they take up that cause. And so that creates different kinds of alignments, where the conservative Christian right, who you'd think, why would they be interested in Africa? What strange bedfellows? But it's happened time and time again.
Is there a split between the kind of Christianity in much of Africa and the kind we're familiar with in the West? For example, wasn't there a rupture in the Anglican Communion over the ordination of gay bishops?
There was indeed. And full disclosure on that, my father is. He retired 3 or 4 years ago from being the presiding bishop of the Episcopal Church. So it was his job in that whole kerfuffle to consecrate Gene Robinson, the homosexual bishop. And to do so, he had to wear a bulletproof vest underneath his vestments. The idea
And that wasn't in Africa.
That wasn't
on the 10th parallel.
That was far from the 10th parallel. That was here in the U.S. of A. And it wasn't that some Muslim crazy was going to come out of the audience. It was that a fellow Christian who had a different notion of who God is and what God wants would actually physically harm him.
It is amazing that there is so much emotion about whether a homosexual has any rights within any church.
It's such, what I will tell you I've heard from, for example, this is not in the book, but years ago I was driving on one road in Congo, in eastern Congo, through a war zone, middle of the night as you do, on some logging road. And the driver said to me, make no mistake, you may have brought the Bible here, it's here with us, and we need it, we need these traditional moral codes to defend ourselves from Muslims.
Eliza Griswold has written a book called The 10th Parallel, Dispatches from the Fault Line Between Christianity and Islam. It was a bestseller when it was published last year, now available in paperback from Picador. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. One of our listeners, Elizabeth, left this question on our show page. She writes, "The Economist recently cited some statistics showing up to 80% of people in some Islamic countries support aspects of Islamic law, such as stoning for adulterers, chopping off hands for theft, etc. How can these aspects not present a clash of civilizations? Do you think that these harsh punishments are cultural phenomenon not necessarily supported in the areas of the 10th parallel?"
Well, okay, so let's break that down a little bit. So Islamic law, or Sharia, is extraordinarily popular throughout the Muslim world, and in Africa in particular, and here's why. In many countries, colonial rule has been a disaster, and it's been corrupt. Like in Nigeria, we were just talking about figures of embezzlement.
Kenya had similar problems.
Exactly. And you can really look across the 10th parallel and across North Africa. We look at the Arab Spring. There are elements within these uprisings that say we need Muslim law. Now, what that's about is, look, it takes a decade for people to get to the courtroom in northern Nigeria, and when they do, they have to pay huge bribes. Not so in Islamic courts. Now, what happens when people actually – it's idealization. Oh, sure, we want Sharia law. Let's go back to our roots. Well, first of all, in many places, there never was Islamic law. So that's already a fantasy. And when it's put into place on the ground, for example, in northern Nigeria, the first man to have his arm cut off for stealing, turns out he was bribed by the governor to let the governor lop off his arm to show he was putting Sharia in place. Once people learn that, they really turn against those precepts.
Isn't there a lot of flexibility within Sharia law?
Absolutely. I mean, the phrase that there's no such thing as a single Sharia. There are many, many variations.
But in a local area, an imam can issue a fatwa, and that becomes the rule there. And then, for example, genital mutilation of women is seen as part of the Islamic tradition, but it's not mentioned at all in the Quran.
Exactly. I mean, I remember being in Waziristan between Afghanistan and Pakistan years ago, and the local mullah had said nobody was allowed to have a bicycle because anybody who had a bicycle would go outside of the area and learn something. And also, nobody could have a water well besides the mosque. There are many forms of local control that are corrupt forms of Islam.
There's a wonderful movie called Mulade by Usman Sabin, in which the men collect all the radios in the town because the women are being corrupted by hearing the ideas from the outside. Yael, another listener asks, do events such as the Arab Spring have an effect on the 10th parallel?
That's a very good question. It's more that the what's going on the 10th parallel foreshadows a lot of what's going on in terms of the Arab Spring. Because, and even 9/11, because what we see here is that within Islam, the same reawakening I've been talking about, that traditional forms of power have lost legitimacy. We have new kinds of reformers coming up, whether they're Yoruba or they're, you know, hawking soda or travel agencies or whatever. And those new reformers challenge traditional law.
I was thinking, we were talking about Sudan earlier, and we did a profile of Omar al-Bashir, the leader of Sudan, who came to power as a co-leader with a religious figure. And then there was a power struggle, and he, the military figure, wound up the one in charge. So how much of this is political, and how much of it is religion, and how much of it is using religion to gain some kind of political effect?
It's a great and impossible question, and it's one of those ones that has no generalized answer, and it's different in every place. I mean, Bashir, for example, you know, has waged the modern world's bloodiest jihad, in his own words, against Christians and Muslims alike. Like those people we were talking about in South Kordofan who are just being hammered on right now, they're Muslims.
The Bush administration was criticized for referring to the war on terror as a crusade. But don't some people see today's conflicts as a continuation of the medieval crusades on both sides?
Absolutely. That was probably the single most unfortunate word that's been uttered in the past decade, I would absolutely say. And yes, in both people believe jihad or crusade, it's a very similar battle cry in many places. And we need to understand that a little bit better because here in New York, we're like, oh, come on. But yes, on the ground, people absolutely believe they're engaged in violent holy war.
Your book has accounts of many hair-raising encounters you had in some of these countries, including a meeting with a militant commander, Sheikh Hassan Dahir Awais, who was wanted by the United States for his connection to al-Qaeda. How do you arrange meetings like that? In the past, haven't any number of journalists wound up being kidnapped?
Yes, that's definitely true. And the photographer I was working with when I was last in Somalia, actually, Jose Senden, was kidnapped when he went back. So this was Eritrea. I was invited into the country. In fact, by Hussein Aidid, a U.S. Marine and former president of Somalia for a heartbeat, who is son of the worst warlord in history. So I got an invitation from this guy. I showed up at the consulate. They said I couldn't even go, but it all worked out in the end.
In the case of Somalia, how much of what's going on there is really proxy war?
A lot of it is proxy war, unfortunately. Okay, so super short history, 2006, Ethiopia invades with U.S. backing, leads to the very thing we're trying to end, which is a popular Islamist uprising, this al-Shabaab group, and now the worst famine in 60 years.
We don't have much time, but I want to talk about Indonesia for a moment. It was largely a Hindu country until the 13th century. Now seems to be one of the most radicalized of all the Muslim countries. What's happened?
Well, again, it's certain strains within Islam that have gotten popular, but the vast, vast, vast majority of Indonesian Muslims, which, as you mentioned before, world's largest Muslim country, world's largest Muslim democracy, are really extraordinarily moderate. and very porous in their beliefs between spirit and Islam. What's happened there is, again, we're looking at a weak government, which in part supported the rise of these radical groups, used them against the communists. And now those groups survive to really wreak havoc and are linked up with al-Qaeda.
To blow up discos where foreigners will congregate.
Or to teach people how to fight against chocolate.
Have you seen any place where de-radicalization has taken place?
I've seen de-radicalization in a lot of places. You know, it's usually pretty well funded. If you can get a car, you're going to put down your gun.
Mm-hmm. Do most of these countries' governments try to downplay religious extremism?
Yes, unless it's in their favor.
Well, in Pakistan, don't we get that's not on the 10th parallel, but don't we get that mixed message?
Absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, that idea of Christian persecution is so virulent in Pakistan. We don't know much about it, but Christians die quite frequently in Pakistan, and it's underreported.
But they're also killing other smaller groups. The Sufis are being killed as being heretics.
Absolutely. And yet I was in Karachi a few months ago, a few days before bin Laden was killed, and I went to a Zoroastrian temple that was alive and flourishing.
In Syria, we are seeing a situation where the Alawite minority is now facing, again, resistance from the Sunni majority. To Americans, they're all just Muslims.
Yeah, and that's probably the most dangerous oversimplification we have in our times.
So how do we – is this just a matter of Americans being better educated? I remember when George Bush became president and people had to teach him the difference between between Sunni and Shiite, and that's the most basic split.
Yeah, exactly. Yes, it's a matter of education. I'd say that's – for me, that's where I begin because I see that as my role. I'm sure an aid worker would say it's a matter of this. But, yeah, education is the place I would say to start.
Eliza Griswold is the author of a collection of poems called Wide Awake Field, which was published in 2007. A new one's coming out in September. Meanwhile, we have her wonderful book about the fault line between Christianity and Islam called The 10th Parallel, now available in paperback from Picador. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.